Well, we have been working our way through the book of Zechariah, and we are now at the last chapter. And I imagine there are a few of you who actually recognize this picture up here. It was just too tempting to include that, the return of the king, a different king, but the imagery is parallel, so we understand that. But I want to ask a very basic question, and that is, what do you know about Zechariah 14? Does that stand out in your thinking in any particular way? Is there something important about that particular chapter of the Bible? And so we want to consider a quote or two on this particular chapter. This is from Eugene Merrill, who is associated with Dallas Seminary in years past and has written many things in regard to biblical commentaries, etc. And he said this: "The cosmic eschatological sweep of this last portion is almost without compare in the prophetic literature of the Old Testament for the richness of its imagery, the authority of its pronouncements, and the majestic exaltation of the God of Israel, who will be worshipped as the God of all the earth." There's another quote that I did not print for you, but let me just note it. This is from someone that many folks have an appreciation for, who is very down to earth, maybe even earthy at times, Dr. J. Vernon McGee. And he said this, and I don't recommend that you necessarily do this, but this is what he said. Quote, "Let me make a suggestion that is really a mean one." You got to know J. Vernon McGee to understand where he's coming from. He was a character. "If you are wanting to know the position of a pastor whom you're not sure about, if you really want to know what he believes, take the 14th chapter of Zechariah to him and ask him to explain it to you. You will find out what a man really believes when he deals with this chapter." We will find out if that is true. The culmination and grand finale of the book of Zechariah is found in this chapter. And when you look at this chapter, there's another book of the Bible that should immediately come to mind, and that is the book of Revelation, because you'll see some parallels there, in addition to concluding chapter of, I think it is, Luke, and the beginning chapter of Acts as well. So we want to take apart this passage and look at it in its respective elements to seek to understand it. There is a lot here, and we hope to get at least a bit of an understanding of what is involved. And so we start off with the first portion of this chapter, and we're calling it the final battle and return of Messiah. And the text reads this way in verses 1 and 2, "Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, and your spoil will be divided in your midst. For I will gather all the nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, and the women ravished. Half of the city shall go into captivity, but the remnant of the people shall be cut off from the city." So the first part of this we're calling the return of the Lord for his people. And that is going to communicate something else here. The Lord will intervene to gather nations against Jerusalem. And this, of course, isn't the only chapter to deal with that in the Bible. There are others, but this one is rather clear on this. And so the Lord announced through Zechariah that a day of the Lord was coming. And that speaks of a time of divine intervention that will be for his purposes. And this is a time when the nations that had plundered Israel victoriously would divide their spoil between themselves in Jerusalem. So it will be a sort of an occupation, a focus on Jerusalem, as we've seen a focus on Jerusalem in the past as well. And this would be the Lord's day in which he would do his will, in contrast to man's day in which man conducts his affairs without divine interference. And there are and have been many of those days that have taken place where the Lord has allowed people to do what they want to do. But this is going to be an intervention of the Lord that he is going to be involved with here. And so it's helpful for us to remember that the reference to the day of the Lord in prophetic literature designates any time when the Lord Yahweh steps into the arena of human events to effect his purposes. And so it is a general designation, and it can be very narrow in its focus, and it can be very broad in its focus. So at this time, the Lord will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to fight against her. And it somewhat parallels Revelation 16:16-21, speaking of Armageddon. And they will capture the city, they will plunder the houses, rape the women, half of the Jewish residents will depart as exiles, but the other half will remain. And this will be one half of the portion of the third part of the Jewish population that will be in Jerusalem that had not died during the tribulation period, referencing back to Zechariah 13:8. And of course, this is yet future, has not yet happened. This is anticipated. So this verse, with its statement that the city will be captured, is sufficient to refute the notion that's popular in certain circles that the times of the Gentiles were fulfilled as of the rebirth of the modern state of Israel. This is anticipated yet future beyond that. According to Lucan theology, after the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled, Jerusalem will be trampled on no more. So since Zechariah 14:2 clearly indicates that Jerusalem will be trampled on again in the future, therefore the times of the Gentiles would seem to extend to the Messiah's second advent. So it is a continuing period of time. And of course, that's also referenced in the book of Daniel, chapter 2:35 and 44-45, where it's anticipating the everlasting kingdom that's going to come. We had already seen in our exposition of Daniel as well. Some expositors also believe that those who flee at this time may seek refuge in Petra. It's at least a consideration as a possible place of seeking refuge, but only time will tell. Again, that is speculation. So then continuing on, looking at verses 3 and 4, then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. And in that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east, and the house and the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west, making a very large valley. Half of the mountain shall move toward the north and half of it toward the south. Now, if you've not had opportunity to go to Jerusalem to actually be on the Mount of Olives, it's probably a little bit nebulous as to exactly what it looks like, but you can look it up and you can see what it looks like. But it's not that big of a mountain. It's just to the east of just outside of the eastern gate. There is a valley, the Kidron Valley, in between. But it's prominent enough. It's recognizable. It is well known. And it is the place from which Christ left the earth. And it was the place that he said he was going to come back to. And that is exactly what this is telling us. So the Lord will return to earth and fight against the nations that have come against his people. So the Lord will then take the role of sort of a divine warrior, and he will fight against those nations for his people Israel's sake. And again, there are other passages in the book of Zechariah that have referred to this as well. He had done this previously where he had protected his people in the process of the Exodus when the Egyptians came back after them and they crossed the Red Sea. And on other occasions that the Old Testament records as well. And so some denominations in their quest for world peace have removed the militant songs from their hymnals, so that the new generation of those that are growing up don't know anything of fighting the good fight of faith or of worshiping the Savior who will one day meet the nations of the world in battle. And that's kind of a it's understandable in one sense because people want world peace and they don't like the idea of fighting, as in fighting the good fight of faith. But on the other hand, the Lord is going to do that big time in probably a way that has never been done or seen before. So there is some element of place for militant songs, and we need to stand up against the challenges that we face in our world today in perhaps a parallel way as well. So the actual order of events in this day would seem to be that the nations assembled to war against Jerusalem, as noted in verse 2, and the city is captured and plundered, also in verse 2, and then the spoil of the city is divided within its walls, at verse 1, and then the Lord's intervention, again in verse 3. And then at that day, the Lord's feet, in the person of the Messiah, will stand on the Mount of Olives to the east of Jerusalem, just east of the Temple Mount area, and just outside the eastern gate. And what's interesting here is that this is the only place in the Old Testament where this name for the mountain appears. In the Old Testament, in the New Testament, it's referenced many times as the Mount of Olives, but here it is in the Old Testament as well. And so since the people were east-oriented in ancient times, Zechariah described this mountain as in front of or as in the face of Jerusalem, facing east. And so the Lord is going to split this mountain in two, apparently with an earthquake, looking at verse 5. And so half of it will fall away to the north, the other half will fall away to the south, leaving an east-west valley toward the middle. Right now there's more or less a north-south valley next to or in between the city of Jerusalem and the Mount of Olives, the Kidron Valley there. But this is going to be in the other direction, so it's kind of an interesting thing. And so also we recognize that an earthquake will accompany the Antichrist's invasion of Israel, as noted in Daniel 7:8 and Revelation 19:20. So this is a rather clear expression of what is going to happen, and it indicates something of the very personal, visible, bodily, literal, physical return of the Lord Jesus Christ in a very powerful fashion at the place that he had predicted himself, but also in this passage as well. Then, looking at verses 5 and 6, then you shall flee through this through my mountain, mountain valley, for the mountain valley shall reach to Azal. Yes, you shall flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, the king of Judah. Thus the Lord my God will come, and all the saints with you. It shall come to pass in that day that there will be no light. The light will diminish. So that's an interesting observation as well. So here we have something regarding the response of the people and of the Lord to the events that are going to be taking place here. The people will flee from Jerusalem before the Lord's return. The Israelites will flee for safety through this valley with mountains on either side. Some parallel passages are also found in 2 Samuel 15, 2 Kings 25, Ezekiel 11 has some similar imagery. And this sounds similar to the Israelites' flight through the Red Sea during the Exodus as well, where they went through the portion of the Red Sea with the water backed up on either side. So it's a similar picture that we would have in view here. And so the valley will reach as far as Azal. Now that word means to be joined to or be at the side of or near. It's referenced in Micah 1:11. But the location of this place as a place is not known to us, but maybe some distance east of Jerusalem. And they will flee just as they did during the great earthquake that happened during King Uzziah's reign over Judah. Amos 1:1 has reference to that as well. Then the Lord will come with all his holy ones with him, namely Christians in heaven and the angels that will come with him. Various other passages reference this as well. I note them if you happen to have your copy of your notes. Psalm 89:5 and 7, Matthew 25:31, Colossians 1:4, 12, 26 and 27, 1 Thessalonians 3:13, Jude 14, Revelation 19:11 to 16. I note those so that you can check them out for your personal reference as well. Zechariah expressed his own relationship with the Lord, his faith in him and his wonder at this revelation by referring to him personally, "Oh my God," personal appeal there. In that day there will be a reduction of light on the earth. The luminaries are noted as diminishing. Literally, it is congealing. Joel 3:15 says, "The sun and moon will grow dark, and the stars will diminish their brightness." Amos 5:18 says, "Woe to you who desire the day of the Lord." That day is coming. It has some positive aspects, but it has some negative aspects too. "For what good is the day of the Lord to you? It will be darkness and not light." Some suggest that this darkness, this loss of light, may be explained by some sort of congealing of the heavenly bodies. This sort of a thickening, as it were, was to the point that they cannot shine. So something, just exactly what the nature of that is, may elude us. There is some sort of loss or change of form that would somehow diminish their luminary capability, but that shouldn't be too hard for us to deal with or to have concern about, since the one that created the stars and the planets and all of the other heavenly bodies wouldn't have any difficulty modifying them from their current form or their functionality. If he can put it into place, he can make it not be functional just as easily. Then verses 7 and 8, we see, "It shall be one day which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night, but at evening time it shall happen, that it will be light. And in that day it shall be that living waters shall flow from Jerusalem, half of them toward the eastern sea and half of them toward the western sea. In both summer and winter it shall occur." Now, another interesting phenomenon is noted here. The Lord will modify light and water as far as its functionality are concerned. So there will be a time of no light, and then there will be some variation of light. It will be like twilight, neither day nor night. In the evening, there will be more light than usual, and it will be a unique time in human history, and it will be a phenomenon that is known, as far as its timing, only known to the Lord. There are other passages that predict some cosmic phenomenon in this day of the Lord. There are a number of them that are more than I want to particularly note, but again, they are listed in the notes that you may have. Bear in mind that this day is an extended period of time, not just a 12-hour or 24-hour period. Of course, context is going to indicate what that is. So the day of the Lord can be very narrow in its focus, and it can be very broad in its focus, looking toward this time of divine intervention in some particular ways. So here it seems that it's more narrow in that it is looking at the end of the tribulation. And we also note that the prophets spoke of the entire time of the tribulation and of the millennium as the day of the Lord. So again, there is both a narrow and a broader focus in that use of that terminology. And there are various ones of the prophets in the Old Testament who made reference of that designation of the day of the Lord, some more frequently than others. But also in that day there would be life-giving water that would flow rapidly out of Jerusalem. Half of it will flow into the Dead Sea. The other half will flow west toward the Mediterranean. And we recognize that living water is often a metaphor that pictures water as a living thing. And it's described as flowing quickly and sparkling in its constant movement and shifting course. And this water will flow year-round, even in the summer, when normally, like this part of the country, the streams tend to dry up, as it would have in Palestine, in that region, but not so much in that particular time. They would not dry up, as might be expected. So the Israelites tended to divide their year into two seasons, frequently as to summer and winter, because of the variance of the weather pattern at that time. And probably the water that's referenced here is literal, but it may have some symbolic reference as well. One commentator noted this. He said, there is no reason to take this whole description here in any but a literal way unless one is prepared to deny the literal coming of Yahweh as well, the Messiah. So this passage validates what other passages have said about the Lord's very literal and truly physical return as accompanied by some great cosmic and physical phenomenon. So it is a very interesting and somewhat of a complex period where there are a number of things that are taking place at the same time. Then continuing on, looking at verses 9 through 11, and here we read, "And the Lord shall be king over all the earth. In that day it shall be, the Lord is one, and his name one. All the land shall be turned into a plain from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem. Jerusalem shall be raised up and inhabited in her place from Benjamin's gate to the place of the first gate and the corner gate, and from the tower of Hananel to the king's wine presses. The people shall dwell in it, and no longer shall there be utter destruction, but Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited." So that's a real change from what the experience had been prior to that. So here we see an emphasis on the provision of security for Israel in the land. And the Lord, or the Messiah, will serve as the ultimate king of all. So in that day, the Lord will reign over the whole earth. He will be the only king. There will be no others. His name will be number one in all the earth. He could have one of those little signs that you sometimes see at ball games that have a finger pointing and it says number one or whatever like that. That would be a literal reality at that time. His name would be number one in all the earth. There would be no other so-called gods, no competition at that time. And this verse refers to Christ's millennial kingdom, as it seems fairly obvious. The reference here to the focus on the Lord is not new. It was something that the generations of Israelites in the past had sung, "The Lord reigns," like in Psalm 93, 97, 99. Where it would be a declaration of faith, but at this time it will be reality. The Lord will reign in a very physical, tangible, real, personal, contextual way. And so when this day comes, he will clearly be seen as the king over the kingdoms of the world. So the Lord's kingdom will be complete. It'll be total. It will be real on the earth as much as it has ever been in heaven. And then there will be topographical changes. The land around Jerusalem will become level, whereas Jerusalem itself will be elevated, apparently associated with a great earthquake. Isaiah 2:2, Revelation 16, 18, and 19. I have a reference in relation to that. In view of the place names that are mentioned in this verse, it probably refers to the literal city and its topography. The town of Geba that was mentioned is 6 miles north of Jerusalem. The town of Rimmon was about 35 miles southwest of Jerusalem. And then the other sites that are mentioned are on all the different sides of Jerusalem, which would indicate its totality. So it seems to be a very real, physical kind of thing that is in view here. And then the people will then live in millennial Jerusalem. So from then on, Jerusalem will not suffer again the depopulation that had been a part of their experience in the past. So they would enjoy security because Jerusalem will be ruled by the Lord himself, and there will be his protection, his guidance, all of that. Now, that doesn't mean the people will be necessarily perfect during that time, because we know otherwise, but there will be a significant amount of security. Now, there are probably not that many places around the world where you could say, this place is really secure. We never have any problems. Nobody ever causes any difficulty. You don't have to worry about anything. There are some places that are less secure than others, no question. We wonder about our own city at times, but this will be real security. So then, moving on to the next section, we see the destruction of Israel's enemies. And this shall be the plague with which the Lord will strike all the people who fought against Jerusalem. Their flesh shall dissolve while they stand on their feet. Their eyes shall dissolve in their sockets, and their tongues shall dissolve in their mouths. That sounds horrible. And it shall come to pass in that day that a great panic from the Lord will be among them. Everyone will seize the hand of his neighbor and raise his hand against his neighbor's hand. So it will cause a fair amount of chaos and perhaps some element of self-destruction in the process. So the enemies of the Lord's people will be struck by him. The Lord will bring a plague on the enemies of Israel. Chronologically, these verses would describe what will follow verse 3, where that's where the movement of the people against Jerusalem, and then the Lord will move against the perpetrators in this regard. So the Lord will strike the nations that had warred against Jerusalem, and this will involve some kind of plague that will cause these people, the combatants against Israel, for their flesh to rot off of them wherever they may be. Now, again, just what exactly the nature of this is unsure. Some have tried to see some sort of nuclear warfare kind of effect. That might be a stretch, but it certainly gives us a picture that we can relate to. Could be some kind of biological or chemical plague. It's hard to say just what exactly is involved, but whatever it is, it sounds to be a very awful kind of situation. So also the Lord will bring panic on Israel's enemies, and it will be a great panic that will seize them. It will be sent from the Lord, and they will fight one another. And that does happen. The Lord sometimes causes people who are against him or against his people to fight against each other and sort of self-destruct. And that seems to be the case here as well. Then looking at verses 14 and 15, Here we read, Judah also will fight at Jerusalem, and the wealth of all the surrounding nations shall be gathered together, gold, silver, and apparel in great abundance. Such also shall be the plague on the horse and the mule, on the camel and the donkey, and all the cattle that will be in those camps. So shall this plague be. So it's not just on the humans, it's on their animals as well. So the reach of the plague will be extensive on Israel's enemies. Judah will fight their enemies and gain various resources. This will be an actual physical response of the Israelites against their enemies. They will gain spoil in the process. They had previously been spoiled as well, or despoiled. And so there are three instruments that God will use to defeat Israel's enemies here. It will be with the plague, it will be themselves fighting against each other in their panic, and the Israelites. So all of that seems to be encompassed in this. And then the plague will also have harmful impact on the animals that is precluding them escaping somehow. Just exactly what, again, what the nature of this plague is not clear, but it will harm not only the human enemies, but also their animals. And then I can't help but think that there's probably a certain organization among us that would not be happy to read that, but that's what it says. And so we don't know just why exactly that may be the case, but maybe there's a different perspective to be had with regard to animals than some people have, in that they are not on the same level as people. We are aware of that, but if somebody wants to say, well, they really are equal, in this sense, they will be equal in terms of receiving that element of punishment. So however you want to deal with that, it's at least something to think about. So then we come to the worship of the ultimate king, verses 16 through 19. And it shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the king, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And it shall be that whichever of the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the king, the Lord of hosts, on them there will be no rain. If the family of Egypt will not come up and enter in, they shall have no rain. They shall receive the plague with which the Lord strikes the nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. I'm wondering how many of us have kept the Feast of Tabernacles. Well, if it has to do with just sleeping out in a tent, I've done that, but not probably at the appropriate time or for the appropriate reason. But it's an interesting consideration that we'll want to think about. So there will be a universal expectation to worship the king. This applies to everybody. Everybody was expected to worship the king. So the survivors of the nations will come to worship the king. The remaining former enemies of Israel who have not died will bow to the ultimate king. They will be expected to make annual pilgrimages to Jerusalem to worship the king, and they were expected to celebrate the Feast of Booths. But then, why the Feast of Booths? That's also the Feast of Tabernacles, or ingathering. It commemorated the Lord's provision of agricultural bounty and the Lord and the Israelites' redemption from Egyptian slavery. And so some have suggested that it's because of that redemption idea and the provision of the Lord that this is to be celebrated. So, yeah, strangers were welcome to participate in it in Israel's past history. So it's not surprising that all the other nations would be expected to participate. It anticipated the entrance into the promised land and the kingdom blessings. So again, you can see a parallel there. Leviticus 23:34-43 address that. The Apostle Peter evidently concluded that the Messianic kingdom had begun when he saw Jesus transfigured on the Mount of Transfiguration, Luke 9:33, because he suggested that the disciples make three booths for Jesus, Moses, and Elijah, because he was thinking in those terms that this is the time. It's the time to celebrate that. And so this seems to indicate that the Jews in Jesus' day anticipated the Feast of Booths being associated with the beginning of the Messiah's kingdom. And so that's not surprising if somebody read that in the right context. So there seems to be this same connection that's made here in Zechariah 14. The Feast of Booths was also the last of the three most important feasts on Israel's calendar, and that time frame may have significance as the last thing to be celebrated. So it would be appropriate for these Gentiles to celebrate this feast in an annual way in Jerusalem as well. And it was intended to be a time of great rejoicing, and it may not have been the only feast that they were expected to celebrate, but it's the one that's mentioned here, and so it seems to be sort of a climactic emphasis that's pointed out here. And again, there are many views as to why the choice was made that the Feast of Tabernacles be celebrated, but most probably because of the joy of the ingathering, of bringing the people together in the presence of the Lord and the Lord tabernacling among them, looking back to John, the first chapter. So the Feast of Tabernacles is the only one of Israel's major feasts that will be unfulfilled until it is celebrated at this time. So there's that aspect as well. There will be consequences to those who refuse to celebrate this feast. As punishment for not making the pilgrimage to attend this feast, the Lord will withhold rain. And we can relate to that, living in this part of the country, which is fairly parallel to the climate in Israel. That was one of the things I noticed when I went there. It's quite similar to here. And so the withholding of rain is kind of an issue. There was also a curse for covenant disobedience to the Mosaic Law that was referenced in Deuteronomy 28:22-24. If you don't obey, you can expect you're not going to get that blessing of the rain. Here, the people from Egypt are given as an example, and the Lord would withhold rain from them. Interesting thing about Egypt is that it didn't depend as much on rain because it could utilize the water out of the Nile. But eventually, if there isn't any rain up the Nile a ways, they would have a problem as well. But all of this is to cause the people to recognize that something as basic as rain is in the Lord's hands, and if they want to receive the blessing of that rain, they need to recognize who it is that is providing it, and failure to do so is going to result in consequences. So this is also focused on the time of the millennial kingdom, and there seems to be some element of some testing there that is going to be taking place for those who don't fully worship the perfect king in whose presence they find themselves. And so there is an expectation of obedience, and there's also reference to the Lord reigning with a rod of iron. So he will bring consequences on those that don't follow his prescriptions. then, looking at verses 20 to 21. In that day, holiness to the Lord shall be engraved on the bells of the horses. The pots of the Lord's house shall be like the bowls before the altar. Yes, every pot in Jerusalem and Judea shall be holy to the Lord of hosts. Everyone who sacrifices shall come and take them and cook in them. In that day there shall no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. Now that's some interesting imagery there to contemplate. There will be a focus on the Lord's holiness. In that day, even the most common things will be consecrated to the Lord. Now, I don't know if you can read it or not, but on this picture of this doorknob here, it says holiness to the Lord, which is exactly what was noted there. I don't know where that came from. I just found it, but I thought that's just too cool. I've got to share that. But the point is that the common things will be utilized in a special way to acknowledge the Lord. So it's sort of consecrated to the Lord. That is for the Lord's use. So even the more common items would be utilized in a way that was comparable to something that would have been like the gold plate on the high priest's turban that would indicate his consecration before the Lord. Exodus 28:36 deals with that. So this again was to remind the Israelites of their holy calling and all other people ultimately as well. So ultimately, there would be this time where people would be truly consecrated to the Lord. They would fulfill their holy calling. The ordinary cooking pots in the temple would be as holy as the bowls that would be used to sprinkle the sacrificial blood on the brazen altar. It seems that at this time, the distinctions between the sacred and the secular would no longer exist because everything would be recognized as holy or set apart to the Lord because you're in his presence at this time. Now, we know that is not currently the case. There are very few things that we would say, well, that's holy, that's in a special place before the Lord. Most things are consecrated to ourselves or to the devil or some other thing. Very little is set apart to the Lord, but there's going to be a change. It will not be that way in the future. And there will be practically nothing that will not be used for service for the Lord. This consecration to the Lord will extend beyond the temple. In fact, every cooking pot throughout Jerusalem and Judea will be set apart to honor the Lord as well. Even the people that would use them would bring their sacrifice to the Lord by their use. And also there would be no more Canaanites in the temple. And probably the imagery there isn't so much that someone who has that Canaanite heritage as much as what that Canaanite represented would be those who were morally and spiritually unclean and therefore reprehensible to Yahweh because the Lord wanted them destroyed because they had been so corrupted by evil. And so the idea is probably the picture that the Canaanite represented, that there would no longer be that representation of evil among them. And so there will be holiness in public life. The reference to the bells on the horses, something as simple as that, or the bridles on the horses. In the holiness in religious life, having to do with the cooking pots used in the house of the Lord, and then holiness in the private life, those pots that would be used in Jerusalem and Judea. So public life, religious life, private life kind of covers all of the areas there. So it reminds us that even common things become holy when they're used in the Lord's service, and this would be a time when people would be in the very presence of the Lord. And we should be reminded that the time will come when the church saints, when Christ returns, will come with him. as we'll note here in a moment. So let me just review a few of the details. So chapter 14 is the climax of this whole revelation in the book of Zechariah that ultimately focuses on the reign of Messiah. You could see everything was sort of leading to this picture. Here we learn that the Lord will deliver Israel through the Messiah who will appear back on the earth, chapter 14, 1-8. The Lord, Jesus, Messiah, will return to earth and touch down on the Mount of Olives, the same place that he ascended from, Acts 1:9. Messiah will then provide final security for the Israelites by destroying Israel's enemies, and the result will be universal worship of our ultimate Lord. All these benefits will occur in conjunction with Messiah's appearance and the setting up of his kingdom on the earth. And there will be a putting in place of any opposition that has been already noted and communicated. So then Messiah will reign as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Revelation 19 makes that very clear when he returns. So Israel will be back in the land and in God's spotlight as he fulfills everything that he had promised to his people. The church saints will return with Christ and will reign with him. We will participate in this time in resurrected bodies and with various leadership responsibilities. And the passage anticipates the glorious return of Christ and the restoration of his people as a grand culmination of history and the fulfillment of all that had been promised in the past. So it really does cover a lot of ground and brings things to conclusion. So that wraps up our looking at the book of Zechariah. And as you recall, there was a lot there, and that followed on the process of going through the book of Daniel. And so what we were basically doing is looking at the prophecies with regard to what is going to happen in the future, how it's going to impact Israel, how it's going to impact other people, other nations, and part of the anticipation was the Lord's coming to the earth initially and then the Lord coming again. And so next time we're going to start a focus on the Lord's first coming, and we're going to consider the promised Messiah, who is also the sacrificial lamb who takes away the sin of the world. And we want to look at the Synoptic Gospels before we begin to look at the Gospel of John, because the Gospel of John is different in terms of its emphasis, in terms of the selectivity as compared to the Synoptics. And so we want to think about, well, how is the Gospel communicated? What is the message of Matthew, Mark, and Luke compared to the message of the Gospel of John? And ultimately, they are looking at slightly different viewpoints to emphasize different aspects of the Messiah, of that one who came to earth and took on human flesh and died on the cross and paid the penalty for our sin, and all of which ultimately bring us to the place of falling down to worship the one who came to pay the penalty for our sin. And so he is the one who is worthy of our praise. And that, of course, is the emphasis of Revelation chapters 4 and 5, where Christ is seen as the only one who is worthy. And we, again, want to recognize that as well. Let's